Spirit Catholic Radio, 88.9 and 102.7, Catholic Radio for the Christian community. Good morning, and welcome to Spirit Mornings with Bruce McGregor and
Chris McGregor.
And dare we say, he's becoming a regular, and we like it that way. Mm-hmm. Dr. Matthew Bunsen, a senior fellow of the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. Dr. Bunsen, of course, one of the United States' leading authorities on the papacy and the church. Also has authored more than 30 books, and since 1997 has served as general editor of our Sunday Visitor's Catholic Almanac, the largest compendium of facts and statistics on the Catholic Church, and is also author of one of the favorite books of Bruce and Chris, John Paul II's Book of Saints. And we're delighted to have him back with us again today, Dr. Matthew Bunsen. Matthew, welcome.
Hello. Great to be with you.
Now, I need to follow up on a couple things we were talking about last week, and in particular, the Society of Pius X. You had so beautifully opened up what the Church was attempting in lifting just the excommunication, not necessarily restoring faculties, but just lifting the excommunication on the bishops. And then we had just mentioned the Holocaust statement that I think it was Bishop Williamson had made concerning that, and we had our discussion prior to Angela Merkel coming out and insisting that the Pope apologize once again for the Holocaust statement, and it just bothered me. How about you?
I think everyone who was listening to us, and you and I, when we were talking about this last week, you knew it wasn't going to be over that easily, because things like this never are. In a way, it's a statement of where we are in terms of trying to deal transparently with a lot of the issues that the Church needs to face, restoring unity.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is that clearly this was something that the Church needed to do with regard to the excommunication. But at the same time, I think in today's media environment, we need to have leaders who are much more savvy in recognizing how everything tends to be interrelated and how we really have to stay ahead of things, because with the speed of the internet and also the sort of reactive quality to news today, I think we need to be much more careful in how some things are done, especially in explaining why we're doing them. This is, I think, a classic case in point, that the Holy Father is trying to rebuild unity, and this is something we talked about last week. But it is abundantly clear now that he was not aware at the time of that, of the egregious statements made by Bishop Richard Williamson regarding the Holocaust. And I read just this morning, first in the original German and then in English, to make sure that I was understanding this right, his interview with Der Spiegel, one of the Germany's leading newspapers, publications. And he seems, once again, to be less than, straightforward in terms of his acceptance of the reality of the Holocaust.
Wow.
I certainly don't want to speak for Bishop Williamson,
but
he is certainly leaving the door open for recanting what he has said. But as he puts it, he's choosing to do so on his terms.
Wow.
That he is looking at new evidence, or wants to look at new evidence that he sees for the reality of the Holocaust. That itself, I think, is somewhat troubling to me personally, because having researched myself for articles and books, it is impossible today to deny the events of the Holocaust. So there's a real disconnect here between historical reality and his position. And the downside of it, the tragedy of this, is that it is complicating what I think was a pretty positive move on the part of the Holy See toward bringing together with the largest schism, certainly in the Church in modern years, and really bringing healing to a lot of people who want to come back to the Church. So, once again, we can only stress that these are two unrelated issues in the sense of the lifting of the excommunication. Was a canonical procedure that had nothing to do with anyone's views on the Holocaust or anything else. It was an effort to bring peace to what is a long-standing schism in the Church.
Mm-hmm.
Bishop Williamson's positions, and unfortunately, as we're now learning those of a few other members of the Society of St. Pius X, are unrelated to that. As we talked last week, you cannot lift the excommunication of these four bishops and then decide, well, we're not going to do him because we don't like what he said.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the way the canon law works. That's not the way that church law works. So I think the failure here, and even George Weigel is expressing considerable disappointment, is the failure of communication among different parts of the Roman Curia, that is, the central government of the Church, in communicating with each other so that the Holy Father had all of the facts prior to the lifting of the excommunication. What's obvious is that that lifting would have proceeded, because, again, they're unrelated. But I think how it was handled would have been very different, and the context and the atmosphere surrounding it would have been entirely different. And I don't think that the problems that we're facing right now, as a public relations fiasco, would have taken place. So that, I think, is one of the lessons coming out of it.
Well, as a leading papal observer, Matthew, would you seem to feel it's necessary that there be an even greater modernizing, and I may be grossly understating this, in the communications offices located in the Vatican? I mean, it seems to be challenged with several of the bigger issues that have come forward in the last couple of weeks.
Right. And that's an issue I think that a lot of leaders in the Vatican are aware of. The idea of the need for greater cooperation and greater integration among the different offices of the Curia, I think, is a real objective that they have. The Holy Father has certainly made efforts to try to organize and reorganize Catholic social communications and that public relations and how the Vatican deals with the world press. We're seeing improvements in internet technology. We're seeing, I think, a greater effort at centralization under Federico Lombardi, the new Vatican press spokesman, who succeeded the brilliant Joaquin Navarro-Val just a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
The difficulty you've got is that you still have a situation in which, say, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith has its obligation. And you will then have, say, the Pontifical Commission Ecclesia Dei, which is the organization that is responsible for dealing with the return to the Church of the Society of St. Pius X. And then you have the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity, for example, under Cardinal Walter Kasper. There is a tendency, I think, because they each have their own specific areas of expertise and oversight, that the levels of communication among them don't really exist very well.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a chronic problem and always has been. So I think you're absolutely right. There is, I think, an issue here of how well the department communicates. And that is a cultural and it's a technological problem. There is the culture of responsibility within the Curia in which these dicasteries, as they're called, these departments, keep things to themselves because a lot of the issues that they deal with are deeply spiritual. They're profoundly important. They're great theological depth. And in some cases, they are related to personal spiritual crises. For example, the Apostolic Penitentiary dealing with sin.
Mm-hmm.
So there is, I think, a tendency toward a presumption toward a discretion, toward not secrecy, but keeping things as discreet as possible. And that's something that has to be overcome as well, to find that common ground in a situation like this, where those members of certain departments who were aware of Bishop Williamson's statements and background probably were not as forthcoming as they should have been to other departments, especially the papal household and especially the Vatican Press Office, which I think was, safe to say, pretty blindsided when this whole controversy struck.
And I don't think that this is something that is just indicative of the papal hierarchy. It is something that we see in government institutions throughout the world, and in institutions, even in business corporations. So for people to sit there and say, well, this is the archaic church functioning, that would be an injustice, given the fact that, that technology and just the means of communication, what we have today, has exploded over the last 10 years.
Oh, I agree. To say that this is indicative of some sort of a failure on the church to, well, one of the things that is sort of hanging in the air here is that somehow, this is the proof once again that the whole Catholic Church is anti-Semitic.
Mm-hmm.
That the reason they didn't do anything about this is because there are so many people in the Vatican who secretly agree with Bishop Lange. Nothing could be further from the truth.
Mm-hmm.
What we're seeing is the fact that the Vatican has never been in a position of having to worry about a lot of these problems in terms of social communication, because the way it was handled in the past was certainly adequate in the sense of how you get your message out. Times have changed, and because of the presence of the Internet, because of the way that news travels so fast, and also the politically and culturally charged atmosphere of things today magnifies a problem like this when it actually hits. And let's be fair. On the one hand, I think to a large degree that the press has been has done its usual job, to paraphrase Federico Lombardi himself, who said it was no better or worse than it always is.
Mm-hmm.
But there are also those organizations out there that revel in the opportunity to attack the church. So in that sense, I think one of the things that the Vatican needs to do is to be much more aware, without being reactionary or defensive, of the fact that what goes out of the Vatican, press releases and documents, needs to be looked at very carefully from how, what sort of perception it's going to give, and also how it can be misinterpreted or misused.
Right.
And you can see the same problem, as you say, with a lot of other institutions around the world. I would think, for example, just the last few weeks with the White House trying to get its message out.
Mm-hmm.
I make absolutely no comparisons between the White House and the Holy See.
Nope.
But there are certain basic rules, as you know, as excommunicators yourself, certainly that you need to do in order to make sure that that's the message that you're putting out. Is the right one, and
right.
That you leave very little room for error on the part of journalists, A, who might be deliberately malicious, or B, most often, who are just really lazy and don't want to get their facts straight.
If you're listening to Spirit Catholic Radio, 88.9 and 102.7 Catholic Radio for the Christian community, Spirit Mornings with Bruce and Chris McGregor, joined this morning by Dr. Matthew Bunsen.
As we were discussing earlier about the Society of Pius X and Bishop Lameson's comments concerning the Holocaust, as a quick footnote to that, it stuns me that the memory of the media is so short-sighted. It was just a couple years ago where our Holy Father was in Germany. He was visiting the concentration camps. Pope John Paul has done that. I mean, there has been consistent acknowledgement of the horrors that have occurred on the part of the papacy. And also, let's not forget that not only were many Jews lost, millions too many, but also quite literally the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Catholics that lost their lives in World War II under the Holocaust.
Well, exactly. And I think one of the challenges here over the last few days for the Vatican has been the fact that this controversy builds over so sharply into ongoing discussions and dialogue, Roman Catholic dialogue with the Jewish faith. It would appear that to some degree this little kerfuffle has been settled. I would refer, for example, to the words that just today there was a delegation from the World Jewish Congress that met with the senior Vatican officials, including, of course, the Cardinal Walter Kasper, as I was saying, is the chief figure in dealing with the church's relations with the Jewish faith. And just issued a statement afterwards to the effect that they understood now what exactly the problem was. And I think they were getting the same kind of details that we've been talking about. Because there, if we're looking at things from the outside, one can only imagine how some of them might interpret what has been going on.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, I think, as they added in their statement, that the debate itself has had a very positive impact, because it has allowed the Holy Father to reiterate his position on the Holocaust, on the Holocaust deniers, and the Church's position in relation to all of that. So I'm really beginning to think of this little mess as a potentially very positive one from the two standpoints. One, I think it has driven home again to the Holy See the need for real improvements in how they deal with communications and the press. And the other, I look at this as increasingly a kind of Regensburg moment,
mm-hmm.
where it was just not that long ago where the Holy Father was under siege for his supposedly hateful comments regarding Muhammad, and all he was actually doing was quoting the 14th century Byzantine emperor. And everyone wondered if he would ever possibly survive that. Well, what has the result been? Well, the result has been that the Church now has a greater sense of dialogue and a greater progress in dialogue with Islam than it has for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because that kind of dispute, that debate, that controversy was a door that could be opened to greater dialogue and greater understanding. And that's what's followed. And the progress of the last few years, as we've talked on this show, in Catholic-Islamic dialogue, has been stunning. And all of it was deemed absolutely impossible just in 2006 with the Regensburg thing. So mm-hmm. maybe looking at something similar here.
Yeah.
Well, it is also a time in the Church, again, it's been a tumultuous couple of weeks where, well, we look at religious orders, and in particular, the one that's in the news very much so now is the Legion of Christ, also known by many as the Legionaries, and their lay extension, Regnum Christi, because of the actions of the founder of the order, Father Maciel. As a church historian, Matthew, it is not unheard that in the life of so many religious orders, well, I suppose you could go back to the Acts of the Apostles and then see even in the early church, in the very early church, the humanness, original sin, creeps in and can shake the foundations of those orders and movements.
Absolutely. This is, let me stipulate for your listeners, just in case if you might be wondering, I'm not a member of Regnum Christi or Legionnaires, and I never have been. So I'm coming at this from the standpoint of somebody who's outside that community.
Right.
So I have the greatest, my heart goes out to all of the members of the Legionnaires of Christ and of the Regnum Christi, because I cannot begin to imagine the heartbreak that they have had to endure over the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
So let's not forget that this late series relations come on the heels of what was already revealed several years ago regarding some of their founder's behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So it's tragic in the sense that a movement that has clearly done so much good have such a shadow cast over it. And the question now emerges, I think, of what's going to happen now. And that, I think, is something that Legionnaires are going to have to wrestle with. And the difficulty is that so much of the movement that was rooted in the work of Maciel de Golano, that I am worried about the ability of the Legionnaires to extricate themselves from this very long shadow that has been cast by him.
Mm-hmm.
To the problems that have been created as a result of these new revelations.
Right.
There is no doubt for Bruce and myself, I mean, we, like you, are not members of Regnum Christi or the Legionaries, but have known so many of them personally and have actually benefited from homilies and instruction and also just the general good works and witnessing to the love of Jesus Christ by many of their members, that we have to believe that continuing thought that St. Paul gave us, that God brings good out of all things. Not some things, but all things. So even out of this, their focus, as I've heard so many of their strong priests, like Father Thomas Williams and Father Jonathan Morris say, that they are a legion of Christ. They're for Christ and their relationship with Christ, and that will keep them anchored and see them through this.
Well, I always take to the standpoint, too, in a situation like this, I try to be very careful about judging someone like Father Massey, L.A., because he's gone.
Right.
Right.
He is now in the hands of God and the mercy of God. The other is that every one of us has our failings. Some certainly are bigger than others, but in cases, these were clearly enormous. What we need to do now is to worry about what we can do as Catholics to help those who are members of Reigning Christi and who are legionnaires in what is a really dark time for them. Then we can ask the question, what is the Legion going to do at this point? And I know that the blogosphere, for example, is filled with many, many suggestions, some helpful, some clearly quite angry.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them, of course, would be for the Legionnaires to reconstitute themselves in a way to reform itself.
And mm-hmm.
That, I think, we can look to the history of the Church to find some useful examples and models. We think, for example, it's not exactly the same, but if we think, for example, the reform of the Carmelites
mm-hmm.
In the 16th century that was pushed so aggressively and so long under Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross and others. If we think of the various renewals that have taken place in the Church throughout the history of our faith, there are opportunities for this, and there are roadmaps to follow for this. And in the end, I think it's going to come down to the dedication of the members, but also a willingness on the part of the leadership of the Legionnaires to find out, okay, who was possibly involved in this, and what did they know, what steps can be taken, and then worked closely with the Holy See to establish what could be a substantially new charism for the Legionnaires, or a new constitution, or some way of rebuilding the spiritual trust and also the personal trust on the part of members in the leadership of the Legionnaires. And I have considerable confidence that is actually attainable, and I don't think I'm being mm-hmm. Pollyannish in this, precisely because of the clear quality of the members that I know personally.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that you can point to Father Morris, for example, and a lot of others who are so clearly dedicated to their vocation and to the ideal that the Legionnaires represent. And the fact that the founder failed to live up to those can be a reminder to all of us that God really does use such flawed instruments to achieve such good in the world.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. And I know that for some areas of the country and some dioceses, there have initially, when the movement, because it took on such a tremendous momentum of membership and life within the United States rather quickly, and its numbers really swelled up and grew. And I know that created tensions in some parishes and in some dioceses, because I think it speaks to a desire of families, in particular, when it comes to Regnum Christi in particular, of a desire to have solid catechesis, solid orthodoxy, something they can really anchor themselves to, which they found in the teachings of the Church, and also of strong youth ministry of that message. And it really is a clarion call to, I would say, bishops and pastors and those involved in formation. What is it that they were seeking, and why could they not find that necessarily in our parish?
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the things that is worth stressing here, that an organization or an apostolate like Reigning Christi is tapping into a real hunger, a real need. You've hit on it exactly. And need is not going to go away simply because there's a crisis facing this particular apostolate. And if the legionaries of Christ, and again, I say this as an outsider, if the legionaries of Christ can reform themselves, really from top to bottom, but especially from with the top, I don't see any reason why the Reigning Christi cannot continue to do the kind of important work that it has been, because the strength of its membership is really going to prove out in the end that there is something still good here, and let's not forget that. And because, again, you're looking at a reflection of the new ecclesial movements, and again, that's something we've talked about over the last couple of years, in the church. Every era in the church raises up new solutions, new ways of transforming society in light of the gospel. And the ecclesial movements are the way that the Holy Spirit is working today. And the Legionaries of Christ, I think, were part of that. Now, every effort like this is often met with really dark and terrible times, be it from persecution, be it from the failure of someone important to that movement. But how that organization, how that apostolate responds, I think will tell us more about the Legionaries of Christ than it ever would about Father Maciel, that he clearly was an imperfect instrument. It is still possible for enormous good to come from that, as we've been saying. That's going to be the real challenge, but this is going to be the part that I'm looking forward to seeing happens here on the grassroots level.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think through this period of suffering, I think they have a lot to teach us, and for themselves to learn. A loving word from someone who, again, is not a member of Regnum Christi, who has been on the outside, but who has been, again, benefited from their witnessing and their charism, that for those who are critics, and there are a lot of critics out there, as you said, for almost all ecclesial movements, there's a critic of somewhere, someone, about something.
Yes.
To be very careful about wagging a finger or saying, aha, or dare I say it, picking up a stone about to toss it at this group at this particular time, because our Lord, he gave us a very strong message about that. I think what we have to, not so much as the aha, but more of, we love you and we're praying for you.
Yeah, it's easy to lose sight in the anger that a lot of people have toward Father Maciel, and frankly, from some of the leadership, from what I've been hearing and reading. That it is easy to forget that you are still talking about many, many thousands of members of the Legionnaires and the Regnum Christi who are impacted by this in their own lives, people who have dedicated their entire existence to helping this movement. And that, I think, is any people who are so desperate to get their pound of flesh or to make some point that, aha, I was proven right in all of this. Let's not forget this.
Right. The goal is not to necessarily be right. The goal is heaven here. Heaven with Christ. I mean, that's for all of us, and for us to take as many as we can with us. So I think our prayers are so much needed. And for many people who have been praying for Christian unity for, dare I say, over 1,000 years, we're getting closer, aren't we? Especially with the Orthodox Church.
Yes. Well, this is the good news of the last couple of weeks.
Yes, there is good news. Right.
Finish on a high note.
and in a way, that's the whole listing of the excommunication of the Society of St. Pius X people. You can look at this as good news. You may not look at it in light of that subsequent event, but it is this impulse toward unity that we are seeing all over. And that has become, I think, a real driving ecclesial force in the Orthodox churches. And we're referring, of course, to the recent election of Metropolitan Kirill of Smolensk as the new Patriarch of Moscow. Now, one can logically ask, well, what does that matter? What is that to us? Well, it's very important to us because Metropolitan Kirill, over the last years, served as a kind of foreign minister for a Patriarch Alexei II, the head of all of the Orthodox in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
That particular patriarchate is the largest in the whole of the Orthodox world. And while they acknowledge not the primacy, but certainly the elevated status, as they say, primus inter pares, first among equals, of the Patriarch of Constantinople, in realistic terms, the most powerful Orthodox church in the world today is that of Russia, mm-hmm. of Moscow. So it does matter in the wider sense of the church who is patriarch there. Metropolitan Kirill was the representative of Alexei to the Vatican and to the rest of the world. And he is one of the most open-minded, one of the most charitable, and clearly dedicated figures in the Orthodox world toward finding unity for the whole of the Christian world. And he is a close friend of Pope Benedict, and I think really represents a couple of important areas of not just agreement, but real common ground between Russia, the Orthodox Church, and the Orthodox world, and the Catholic Church. Starting first and foremost, I think, with the idea of trying to heal long-standing historical divisions. And it's easy to forget that the separation took place in 1054 between the Holy See and Constantinople, mm-hmm. Greek Orthodox, and that naturally spread across the Orthodox world. So we're talking about something that's over 1,000 years old in terms of a separation. So that's not going to be healed easily.
That's right.
The other, though, is the recognition that in Russia today, in Europe, in the world, we have got to reach an accord on issues of culture and belief and the role of religion in the lives of the average person. The Russians have looked with great alarm, the Russian Christians, at the spread of secular humanism throughout Russia in the wake of the demise of the Soviet Union, where you had an officially atheist state that left behind it a legacy of social ills and social disaster. Russian society is almost in ruins in terms of the human spirit. When you have a society that has the average Russian woman in her lifetime would have had 9 abortions.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow.
You are looking at a social crisis supersedes almost anything that we even know here in the West.
Oh, yeah.
And the inroads of the hedonist culture from that sort of unrestrained and this wild free market system that has promoted even the most excessive forms of hedonism, of organized crime, of drug addiction, of alcohol addiction, combined with a shrinking population base, and an Orthodox Church that is itself in Russia, still working as hard as it can to rebuild the trust of the Russian people after having been under the thumb of the Soviet Union for so many decades.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things together represent a real challenge for Christianity in Russia. But on the plus side, I think Alexei II did make real progress in making the Orthodox Church socially relevant to the new Russia. And in so doing, it created, I think, a bulwark to some degree in the East for authentic Christian culture, which has always been a hallmark of Russian life.
Mm-hmm.
That so much so that even Stalin could not purge it, and 70 years of atheism could not get rid of it. What we're going to see, I hope, with Alexei is further bridge building between the Russian Orthodox Church and the Holy See in making those kinds of accords, speaking out on the rebuilding of the Christian heritage of the West and the Christian heritage of Russia for the betterment of the whole of Europe. And from that, I think a real revival of Christian culture, not just in Western Europe, not just missionaries across the world. And that's something I think that he is deeply committed to. I know that because in his opening address as patriarch, Dale stressed repeatedly the idea of Christian culture, of rebuilding Christian civilization, as the only real response to materialism, to atheism, and to that rejection that we have seen across Europe of that magnificent Christian patrimony that built Europe in the first place.
It really is a witness to the adage that the gates of hell will not prevail against it.
Yeah.
When it was able to survive Stalin. I mean, if you're able to survive Stalin, the worst mass genocide culprit of the 20th century, and you survive that and you still have a remnant, I mean, that's miraculous.
Yes, yeah. And so much so that Vladimir Putin, the ruler and leader, however you want to describe him, of Russia, one of the first things he did was to forge close relations with the Russian Orthodox, because he recognized that if you're trying to build some kind of cohesive national state, politically, socially, culturally, you really need to bring in the legacy of Christianity in Russia. I mean, we're talking about a faith that dates back 1,300 years or so, that really became the backbone of Russian history. The faith of the average Russian peasant was what allowed them to survive events of the Mongol invasion, the tyranny of the boyars. I mean, the list is almost endless, all the way to the Russian Revolution. And as you say, the fact that the Soviet Union could not exterminate Orthodoxy tells you something. Now, it did its best corrupt it to turn it to its own uses, but in the end, I don't think anyone could have anticipated that the Soviet Union would collapse the way it did. Now, there are a lot of reasons for that, and as we discussed on this show, John Paul II, the internal collapse of the Soviet system, but one of the things that I don't think can be overlooked is that simple faith of the Russian people that managed somehow to keep that little mustard seed alive, even in the darkest winters of Russian life in the 20th century.
I'd say it's the intercession of Our Lady. That's just my opinion.
Well, I would agree, definitely.
There we go.
Dr. Matthew Bunsen with us today, and well, I'll tell you, Matthew, the time just flies when we're together. I'm sorry that we're out of time today, but we look forward to each and every conversation that we're able to have with you to really become enlightened and go deeper on a lot of these issues out there that certainly the secular media isn't going to touch, but we in Catholic Radio will keep our eye on.
Well, let's hope next time I'm on that the news is a little better. I expect it will be.
Matthew, again, thanks so much for being with us. Always a treat. God bless you, my friend.
My pleasure, and I hope that the wider signal is going well and being well received.
You're being well received, always and everywhere.
Much appreciated.
All right, thanks.
Take care. God bless.
God bless you, too.